Welcome to the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We'll talk to fellow entrepreneurs and share stories of success, failures, and epic failures in the quest to understand the business, art, and science of the indie revolution in the city of big shoulders.
Hi, welcome to the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. This is our first pod, so we're kind of just testing and working everything out. So apologies in advance for any quality issues.
And the purpose of this podcast, I want to share kind of this inside look at starting and running an indie game business. We're really looking at all sides of this kind of indie revolution. It's really kind of the merging of this art, science of making games, and then also the business side. And we'll give you the insight on our own successes and failures and lessons. So I'm Kiwon Hong with my co-host, Rob Lockhart.
Hi.
We work together at the Chicago Indie Toy Studio Games, and we've both gone on to start our own indie companies right here in Chicago. Do you want to say a little bit about yourself, Rob?
Sure. So I am the creative director of Important Little Games. It's an educational game studio, and we do two things. I'm working on a bunch of contracts for clients, and I'm also working on an original game called Codemancer. I'm sure you'll hear more about that.
Yeah, Codemancer is looking really cool. You actually had Jesse Shell play, right, recently?
Yeah, that was awesome of him to do.
Rob will give you his contact info, but definitely go out and check that. There's a YouTube video of it, and it's, I don't know, I think the game looked really interesting. I'm biased because I've been with it like since its very inception, but I think it's looking really cool. I'm the one-man studio iterator of games. I completed a Kickstarter last year for my cyberpunk shooter contract work, and currently working on the full release. You can play the pre-release right now, but I'm working on a bigger release of that, and then also have a couple as of yet unannounced projects. So yeah, ooh, interesting things going on.
Yeah.
And then me and Rob actually have a little co-venture we started a couple months back. And yeah, I mean, we basically jammed this thing out in like 40 hours or something like that, and I think the prototype turned out well. I'm excited to see where it goes. So,
likewise.
All right, so part of what we want to do on this podcast is bring in a guest every week, and the guest can be someone from the games industry or just, you know, the Chicago business scene in general, and want them to come in and kind of share their experience, and we'll also give them what we're calling our Gamepreneur Design Challenge. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and bring in this week's guest. Dyack, thanks so much for being on the Gamepreneur Podcast. So a little background, we worked together at my first real job, Vibes Media, when it was like super small. We were what, like 15 people when you were there?
Something like that.
And like, it was like we had people like sleeping on the floor. We had like new hires in the hallway working off like TV trays. It was pretty ghetto. And now it's like almost, it's over 100 people, right? I mean, there's been like 400 people that have worked there.
Yeah, probably something like that.
So it was a really unique experience. Do you have any like thoughts or things that you can share with us just in terms of like, okay, we came out of this like really crazy space and we were successful. Anything that you feel would be like,
I need some background. Like, what does Vibes Media do?
Oh, I guess it's
go ahead, Dyack.
Vibes Media is a mobile marketing company. We're actually a technology company. We have a platform that helps our clients run mobile marketing campaigns. So basically what we're trying to do is enable our clients to communicate directly with their customers via mobile, because mobile is just basically the platform of the future.
Right on. So does that mostly take the form of like push notification stuff, or like banner ads, or
not really.
Apps
well,
that you develop, or
For the most part, actually, we do it over SMS. So it's all it's not a lot of it's text message based, but we've branched out into other channels as well. So we do some like mobile web stuff as well as some Twitter stuff. Basically, we're kind of looking to where the market takes us. I mean, it's kind of one of those things where, as a growing company, you really want to experiment with what is out there and what takes, because we don't know the answer. I don't think anyone really knows the answer of what's going to come next.
So it's kind of the fast prototyping, fail fast kind of thing.
Ah, definitely. We follow a lean kind of process at work. So, you know, we really want to get features out there quickly and understand if they work or not. And if they don't, we've only wasted the minimal amount of time, so we can do something else and basically, like you said, fail fast.
Yeah, I think that's like really important, especially in a smaller company. I know that, you know, sometimes it feels that the bets you're making is like you have to do this or you're completely going to go under. But I think it's important to kind of have that fail fast mindset and not make bets that like one big bet that'll put you under. You really want to be doing like smaller bets and saying, okay, if this doesn't work, we need to be able to change and pivot really quickly and do something different.
I mean, that's even important for big companies too. They can make bigger gambles or bigger experiments, but you don't want to become stagnant. You want to be stuck in a single industry, and then when that comes out underneath you because you didn't respond fast enough and destroys everything, you really don't want that. So, I mean, lean applies for companies of any size.
Yeah. It's interesting because I remember
gas industry.
Say again?
I said, listen up, oil and gas industry.
Yeah, well, maybe they should go. Who knows?
Well, we're all going to be driving Teslas in 3 years anyway, so.
Right. That's what I'm saying. They should become what they say they are, which is energy companies. Anyway, that's a totally other conversation.
So this is kind of interesting. So, Dayak, when you're at Vibes, like when you first started, you were part of this very kind of unique department that we had. It was just called the Innovation Department. And I never actually figured out like exactly what you guys did, but there were certainly some like really like wild like experience going on. Was there anything like really like shocking or interesting that kind of came out of this basically open mandate to just be innovative?
No, not really. I think innovation is something that it's kind of an industry buzzword nowadays. There's a lot of different companies that like making departments that are specifically around trying out new things. I mean, it's kind of part of that lean philosophy. Occasionally, you even see people at C-levels that have innovation titles. So I think we're just kind of ahead of the ball a little bit there. Just giving someone the opportunity to look at where systems might go, or even verify that there's places you don't want to go. That's just a really valuable use. And, you know, spending one or two full-time employees doing that is not a lot. When you have like a medium to large size company.
I feel like that is kind of part of the tradition of that IBM and Bell Labs started.
Right, yeah. And like Xerox AT&T, too, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Xerox and Google, all those companies have things like 20% time or days of impact where they actually really let their employees go and do things that interest them. I mean, I think that's a great kind of initiative with those kind of companies because it won – makes their employees happier, which of course is always better for efficiency later on. But at the same time, just gives them the opportunity to explore new things without having to force upper management or anyone in management to think the ideas up. You kind of tap into the creativity of your entire company with those kind of policies.
Yeah, I think it's important that you don't that you let yourself experiment. I think sometimes when you're like a really small company, it can be like, oh, we need to just pay the bills or we're going to sink here. But if you're not experimenting, you're not really, doing anything interesting that's kind of building value down the road.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
I mean, how do you think companies ought to sort of avoid pressuring their these kinds of departments to innovate along a certain direction that has kind of an obvious business case? You know what I'm saying?
That's an interesting question. The thing about innovation departments or innovation groups is that it's still a business, right? You don't have, guys go look into what's the next thing for Toast if you're working in software. That doesn't make sense, regardless. So you have to there has to be some limitations in there somewhere. But at the same time, it's really, you kind of have to trust them. I mean, what it really comes down to, you have to let them, go a little way and see if what they come up with. And if it's, way off track, then you have to correct their course. But I think it really is, it's about finding people you trust.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's an important point in that innovation isn't something that's necessarily going to like pay off tomorrow, right? It could be something like you just kind of give them time and like space to like think about ideas. And then like much later down the line, you're actually going to be like, oh yeah, this thing that we thought up, like, way back when is going to be something that's going to be big. But it's not necessarily going to be the thing that's going to show up on, you know, our next quarter.
Also, but I think a great point that Dayak was making was that hiring is like probably the most important part of an innovation department, which is like borne out by the example I gave of Bell Labs. Like, these people, you know, they were free to do whatever they wanted, basically, but they were also amazing, amazing people. Like, that was Claude Shannon was there, or, you know, just intense geniuses. And that's what kind of Valve is trying to do, I think.
Valve's an interesting space.
Valve's an interesting company. I sometimes look at Valve's moves and how they do things, and I find it just... I'm always torn between if they're just geniuses or evil geniuses. Because they have a policy of where they allow all kinds of people to publish on their platform, and they basically are using the entire communities as innovation labs. So people can try what they want, and they can look at, and they get the data directly about what's doing well and what's not doing well, and they can kind of synthesize that data to make intelligent choices. So because they're kind of getting all that data for free, whether it's evil or not, I'm not quite decided yet, but I really do like what Valve does in general from a business perspective, just because it's kind of breaking the mold in a lot of different ways.
But I mean, what's the difference between what you just described and like what the App Store does, what Apple does with the App Store?
Oh, actually very little difference. I think the only thing that's a little bit different is that Valve is better about basically promoting their community. I think that's what makes it not 100% evil. Like, the App Store definitely is much more mercantile or mercenary, but Valve really does see the value that they're getting as well, and they acknowledge it. So they help people, and they make it open. They make it a lot easier to get things on there.
Well, I will say that the one thing Valve is doing that Apple really isn't is that Valve does have products in their own store, right? So you look at Team Fortress 2, and I've heard that Team Fortress 2 is basically like Valve's kind of like secret testing ground. I mean, it's an awesome game. But what they do is they kind of build in these little tests into Team Fortress 2. So things like hats, right? Mm-hmm. Hats were the test to see, like, will this system support, like, in-game purchases? And they just kind of, you know, they wrapped it into TF2 just to do a little experiment there.
Mm-hmm. And they do the same thing with Linux support.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's definitely, like, one of those.
Apple does have stuff in the App Store. No games, but they have, like, pages and... Keynote and stuff like that.
That's true, yeah. So yeah, maybe there's a little going on both sides there. So Dyke, you ready for the challenge?
Sure.
So what we're doing, we've got a few questions that we wrote out, and Rob's gonna spin the wheel and pick one at random for Dyke.
Okay.
Dyke, have you prepped for these questions at all?
Nope.
All right, so it's just gonna be off the cuff.
All right. So the first question is, how can we save the pinball industry?
How can we save the pinball industry? I guess my first instinct for that one is, does it need saving? Is there something to save? I mean, I really like pinball games. They are fun, and they're kind of nostalgic and throwbacks, but I don't see, like, there is a market there that we need to build out. It's like, I don't know, it's like you can synthesize a pinball game inside a software program, or you can have the physical product, but that kind of seems like such a niche market that there's not much growth there to save. That's kind of like asking how to save... asking how to save knickknacks or the antique industry. It's like, it's there, but it's not like there's something you really need to put together. If you wanted to say, like, if there was a company, I guess it just kind of brings the scenario a little more down to real life, that was focused on pinball, and how could that particular company be saved so that they could change themselves to something that's more modern? I mean, it would be something that's going to be more digital and distributed. Like, if you want to talk about the growth markets in gaming nowadays, it's a lot of, I don't know if it's a good term or a bad term, but a lot of that casual market, that pinball kind of seems to appeal towards. So if I were to say anything, you know, making kind of a pinball mobile game or some sort of semi-social pinball experience would actually be kind of cool.
There are several pinball games that have like a pretty strong following.
I mean, here's an interesting thing in that due to like the 3D printing kind of revolution that's going on right now, right? It's kind of easier to create like really specialized components, right? This is me just like thinking about a pinball machine and going like, okay, there's lots of these like little specialized parts that were probably like expensive to manufacture back in the day. So, you know, a pinball table is an expensive thing to build when you had
to maintain. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm thinking, okay, we've got these 3D printers that can print intricate things for much less than they used to cost to make. How about saying, like, I'm going to have this digital pinball company, but I'm going to let people, like, buy a physical machine of their favorite digital game. And I'm just going to 3D print the whole thing.
That's interesting. Print on demand pinball machines.
Yeah, so this is kind of like targeting the niche market, right? Like, I love pinball, I love this game, and now I can actually have this machine in my living room.
It's like you take the whales from the mobile game or whatever.
Right, and this is definitely like a 1% play.
Is like, yeah, get the actual machine. That's a cool idea.
Yeah, I guess I just wonder if, I mean, I guess my playing devil's advocate here is like, why don't they just buy the original machines? You think that a pinball enthusiast and collector would want, like, the real thing?
Well, yeah, if this is, like, I'm bringing, like a Back to the Future machine, yeah, definitely then let's go get, like, the real machine, right? But this is, like, saying, like, I made this pinball game, and my thing is, like, you know, something, I don't know.
Yeah,
it's just, like, a new game that has never been made before in physical form, but now I can own it through this, you know, this digital printing thing.
Like, the Star Wars pinball just came out. There's a new version of Star Wars pinball for, like, consoles that's it doesn't have any physical equivalents. I'm not sure if they are strictly bound by, like, this thing is even possible to manufacture, though.
That's true, yeah. If we got, like, warp gates and stuff, that might be difficult.
Yeah, and it kind of begs the question, if there are even going to be enough people buying the physical machines to even put together the infrastructure. Because you're talking about someone has to print it out, and, I mean, 3D printed objects aren't perfect, so they're sanding and putting together. A lot of man hours kind of go into that. I mean, pinball is still a niche product, and people actually really like it. One of the YouTube channels I watch, the guy specializes in making custom pinball games, but, I mean, and he 3D prints a lot of his pieces, but it's not like you can just print it out and then it's ready to go. Like, 3D printing right now is just plastic and all the pieces need sanding, as well as, you know, you can't 3D print metal or the electronics together. You can.
You can 3D print metal, not electronics, but yeah. You can do laser sintering on metal shavings, basically.
Oh, is that like the metal sand and then they use a laser to melt it down?
Uh-huh.
That's not the cheap end of 3D printing.
No,
that's the expensive end of 3D printing. I mean, that's an interesting idea. I think just digitizing the whole thing would probably be cheaper and have a much larger profit margin. But, I mean, yeah, if you're going after the collector market, it's pretty decent to say that, you know, you can print it out, or even you can have them print out a scale model in their own home that works. I mean, that might be a nice thing to do instead of having that big giant machine in their living room. You can instead be like a desktop version.
Huh.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think the idea here is that, you know, if you're trying to have a pinball company, right, your main product is going to be digital, right? You got this digital product that, you know, people can play. And then, yeah, for your higher end, for your whales, you've got this, like, okay, if you love this game and you feel like spending like 10 grand on it, we'll actually like deliver you the table.
Yeah. I mean, that'd be a pretty good test, I guess. If you want to take a lean approach to it, what you would really do for that is that you would offer that, you would put a large wait period on it, and then see if you can get, when you get enough orders to actually cover the costs, that's when you start making it. Other than that, you'd be like, oh, wait, we decide we're not making this, and, you know, it's not going to cost you anything, but It's kind of like your own internal Kickstarter.
Have like a waiting list kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. When the waiting list gets a certain size, when you can start manufacturing them. But up to that point, you don't really want to invest until you know that there is a market out there for that.
Good point.
You know, I'm wondering about like the... We have a bar here in the neighborhood called Emporium that has a large like selection of like old pinball machines. I wonder if there's...
And newer ones. They have
and newer ones, yeah.
They have a Tron Legacy machine. It's really cool.
I wonder if there's a market specifically for like that type of venue, right? This is looking at like a bar slash kind of nostalgia type pinball venue. I wonder if there's like a market specific for that. Using that same model we talked about, right? We're not gonna like try to build these machines as they were once built. We're gonna try to take advantage of the newer technology just to manufacture them at a cheaper cost.
Possibly. I guess it matters how many of those bars exist.
Yeah. So there's only two, I think, in Chicago. And a third might be opening up soon. But I know there's one in Portland and one or two in New York City. But they're, I mean, definitely not huge. What would be interesting, I think, there is like if you wanted to create the demand as well as the supply, you could sort of make kind of a franchise of these things, like Chuck E. Cheese for grown-ups, where you make, you know, the three-ring binder of how to make your own barcade. Mm-hmm. and try and duplicate that model all over the place. And then now you have demand for all of these like digital and physical arcade machines.
Yeah, in that model, I think you want to lean more on the nostalgia aspect. Because the Dave & Buster's is kind of like the adult Chuck E. Cheese's.
Yeah.
But Emporium is definitely not Dave & Buster's, right? Emporium is going for more like you grew up with these games. Yeah. Definitely has that hipster edge to it. But, you know, I get a different feel when I'm at Emporium as opposed to when I'm at Dave & Buster's.
For sure. It's less like a casino. Dave & Buster's feels like a casino minus the gambling.
I can't win any money here.
You can win a big stuffed rat or something.
Yeah, the stuffed rat is definitely my first pick every time.
Cool. Should I ask another question or do you want to move on?
Yeah, let's do another question. Dyke, if you're up for it.
Sure, no problem.
Okay. Fake wheel sound. So create an alternate free-to-play business model for EA's new Dungeon Keeper. First of all, have you played the new Dungeon Keeper?
I have played the new Dungeon Keeper. It was interesting because when it came out, it was much maligned on the interwebs and all the reviews kind of scenarios because. Well, the original game was a really well-loved game, and I played that as well, and I actually really, really enjoyed that old game. Mm-hmm. And I played the new one, and if you compare it to the old game, it is awful. It's terrible. But if you take it as the kind of, you know, time-based slow play game where you do something and you come back a day later and do something else. Mm-hmm. It kind of is actually one of the best ones of that version I've ever, this kind of games I've ever played. I mean, I played Tiny Towers and I played the new Simpson one. Mm-hmm. And those various kind of games.
Yeah.
But yeah, then Farmville and those kind of things. And I never really got into those for an extended period of time, mostly because like the premise wasn't interesting. Like I didn't care about the farm or this stupid tower that I made. I mean, there's even a Star Wars version of Tiny Tower, and I played that for a while, but I just got, I don't know, there wasn't enough customization or building. But one thing that's interesting about Dungeon Keeper and the new version of it is that, I mean, you are managing creating your own dungeon, but it's tile-based, and you can move things around, and it's mixed with tower defense, so there's an aspect of you trying to figure out how exactly you want to build your defenses, and mm-hmm. you know, there's like efficiency questions. So I actually really enjoy the game. I haven't spent any money on it whatsoever because I kind of refuse to give EA any money, but I couldn't think of a way to improve it. I mean, the thing that you would pay for in the game is that you pay for making the time go faster. And that's probably the best thing you could possibly do. And unlocking other things, you can always pay to get more unique monsters as well as making the game go quicker. But other than that, I mean, that's what they have now, and I couldn't think of anything else that would add to it, to be entirely honest.
So basically, like, the haters are going to hate.
Yeah, I mean, if you compare it to the original game, they have made an abomination. But if you think of it as a completely different game that's just taking, like, the IP and the skin of it, then I don't think it's that bad. Once you take that whole entire old game out of your mind and take it as what it is now, and just as a flavor of another kind of game, I think it's one of the better versions of that genre of game that I've seen. At least it's kept me enthralled, or at least playing for longer than any of the other ones have. I mean, even the one that was Simpsons, which I actually really enjoyed, got kind of tedious and boring after a while because, you know, you don't get the same sense of unlocking new things or, you know, a puzzle as to, you know, the placement of your buildings and units. And traps actually matter. You know, in Simpsons, it just doesn't matter where you put it. It's all aesthetic. And from a gameplay perspective, I don't particularly care about how my city looks. But to get like an idea of like, oh, this time, you know, it took them longer to trash my whole entire dungeon because I actually designed it better. That's interesting to me. It lets me create my own goals. It's kind of, I guess, in a lot of ways, kind of reminds me of Minecraft in that the game definitely has its own track, but when you're trying to design how your dungeon works, defenses, you're kind of making your own goals. Or, you know, if you're trying to mine the whole entire map out, which is going to take days, or if not weeks or months, it's still like your own mini goal. That has nothing to do with what's designing the game, but that makes it fun, even though it takes a long time.
Hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting. You know, maybe the first thing they should have done was not called Dungeon Keeper.
I mean, I think Dungeon Keeper made it so that they could sell the game. Like, people, you know, wouldn't have got it. It wasn't called Dungeon Keeper. Like, that's the only thing maybe even look at it. It did. I think that's one of the interesting things about kind of game reviews in general, is that the reviewer's job is to make game reviews, not necessarily play the entire game. So the game comes out, the game reviewer isn't going to spend, like, I have, you know, 2 months playing the game because they need to get their article out, you know, 2 months ago. So, you know, they work with what they have, right? They work with comparing to the old game, and that's just it's not a fair comparison because it's not the same kind of game. It's still EA money grubbing. Like, that's never going to be beside the point. But I think it was unfairly called terrible. Oh, it was very fairly called terrible, but for the wrong reasons, for that way.
Yeah, it sounds like they actually made a good game in the genre. It's just not Dungeon Keeper, like the old Dungeon Keeper that we knew. And that does feel a little unfair because it sounds like, you know, whoever their team was actually took the time to make a pretty good game.
Yeah,
sounds a lot like, I haven't played the game, but it sounds a lot like Clash of Clans.
That's interesting, because I have not played Clash of Clans yet, but I keep hearing things about it and seeing commercials for it, and that also sounds like a money-grabbing thing, but is the game itself good? I don't know. Have you played it?
A little bit. And I don't know, it's not my kind of thing. I can see the appeal, for sure. But again, it has that, like, it has time gates, and then it also it has the tower defense sort of aspect to it.
Ah, that's cool. Maybe worth checking out one of these days. I mean, I think the thing that I particularly like about those kind of time-gated games is that it's something to do, you know, over the course of weeks that, you know, I don't have time at work or while I sleep to keep managing it. So I like the idea that I can press a button and the device does work in the background while I'm sleeping to something else to keep moving me forward. So when I check in 8 hours later, I actually feel some sense of progress. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like this nice, it's almost like a kind of a hobby. It's not something you like, you wouldn't want to sit down with this game for like 4 hours and play it nonstop. No, you would get really bored. But for that kind of background, kind of casual kind of sense, I kind of like it that way.
Yeah, there's certainly something to be said for the longer form engagement games. Like the most obvious example is like fantasy sports, right? That's not something that you go down and you like play fantasy football for 4 hours. It's something that you do, over the course of the season. And obviously it's got a very, very big following.
I think the objection that people have to time gated games, and I'm not necessarily one of these people, but the concept is there's no intrinsic reason why you shouldn't be able to keep playing the game. The time gates are just kind of arbitrary.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, and in the case of fantasy football, it's actually not an arbitrary gate. The season
it's like
only
you're
goes
done.
Quickly.
You've
yeah.
done all the things that you can do. Whereas in this, they just make up this concept of like energy or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that. In terms of that is that kind of that can ruin a lot of games because you know why do I have to wait 18 hours for this to finish? But I think that's always from the perspective of if you are planning to sit down with a game for like a couple hours, yeah, that's terrible. You basically play for 5 minutes and then like, oh no, I have nothing else to do. But I mean, if you think of it in terms of, I don't know, it's kind of, I guess to me, it's kind of like a new form of gardening. So it's something that I can come back to every now and then. And I'm not really thinking that like, oh, I need to sit down and play this game. And so like, oh, you know, it's like a modern Tamagotchi in a lot of ways. You guys ever had those
of
or
course.
Of them.
Yep.
But that's kind of like, I think when you think of it in that lens, it becomes a completely different kind of evaluation. If you think of it in terms of a normal game, no, they're all terrible because you're right. They're completely arbitrary about these points. It feels like they're just trying to get money out of you, which is why, you know, if I make it the goal to never give EA any of my money for that particular game, then, you know, the time gates
then
don't
the easiest
feel,
way to win is not to play.
Well, the time gates don't feel, they feel like actually part of the game mechanics because now I'm just, you know, this is, like I say, I'm managing my plant. It's my little base sim.
It's really funny. You've almost created this metagame around the game that's there. The game, the object being don't give EA any money.
Yeah, and it's funny because like a couple weeks ago they had a promotion where if you bought anything, like just anything at all, spend any money, they would give you a free extra imp. And, you know, imps are the things that actually do stuff. And, you know, that basically going from 3 to 4 imps would, you know, give you 33% more working power. But I was like, no, I still don't want to give them any money. No, they get nothing from me other than my eyeballs looking at their ad. But I don't really care about that either.
Yeah, that's the thing, too. All right, well, I think we're going to wrap up the segment. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on, and lots of interesting stuff. A lot of interesting topics that I think we'll probably come back to in later podcasts. So
absolutely.
Yeah, no problem.
Very cool.
Thanks
so much. All right,
thank
you much. A lot of interesting topics that came out of that, much more than I was expecting. What do you find interesting, Rob?
Well, so I like the comparison Dyack made to sort of a cottage industry or like antiquing, in that it's maybe not something that needs to be saved in the sense of like go back to the scale that it once had.
Mm-hmm.
But there are definitely ways to like deepen the pinball industry for the enthusiasts, and we brainstormed those, which I think is really cool. Like to maybe make the comparison to like the car industry, you could say that like pinball is like antique cars, but there's room to make there's room for sort of business improvements in the realm of antique cars. Like there are people who build like chassis adjuster type things so that you can fit modern engines into old cars, and all kinds of new parts that just fit old cars and don't fit the newer ones.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It reminded me of, if you ever heard like Seth Godin talk about finding your tribe, right? Mm. And all you need is like 1,000 people, right? And I'm sure there's 1,000 people that would, you know, pay to have old pinball machines, right? So there's definitely like, instead of looking so mainstream, let's find our tribe and let's find out what they need, right? Let's find out what they're asking for.
Yeah. So it's not, you know, pinball is never going to be a sexy industry again, but it could still be sort of a very lucrative one.
Yeah, yeah. Although I don't know, if you can get the high score on Back to the Future Emporium, you'll have those hipster chicks all over you. So
absolutely.
All right, so we'll roll into one of our kind of repeating segments. It's called One Piece of Advice, and this is kind of us just telling you, you know, based on what we're going through right now, you know, we've got our different projects going. If we could tell you one piece of advice for the week, what would it be? Go ahead, Rob.
Well, my piece of advice has to be taken with a grain of salt. I think an interesting thing to think about is just saying yes to everything. I know that it kind of runs counter to a lot of advice that I've been hearing about, like, you know, time is your most precious sort of resource as a as a startup founder.
Yep.
And that's definitely true. But at the same time, the sort of favors that you can accumulate, or just the contacts that you can accumulate by saying yes and going out and like having coffee with somebody, or like, you know, helping them out recently I went to some career fairs at like a middle school and a high school, and those were just favors that I was doing for random people that I know through educational organizations around Chicago. And those are the people that, you know, I value that relationship with that I have with them. So I'm just trying to maintain and strengthen them. And in the past, I've gotten contract jobs based on, like, right now I'm in negotiations for a job with somebody who I hadn't spoken to for like 2 years, but 2 years ago I had coffee with this person and just talked about educational games with them. And I'm really glad that I did, because that might turn into an opportunity for Important Little Games. So say yes and go meet people and help them out.
Yeah, I think it's really important not to isolate yourself too much when you're doing your thing, whatever it may be. It's important kind of to keep pulling in outside sources, just even like to talk with an old friend or something like that.
Absolutely.
I've been reading a book on flow, right? The creative process. And a big part of that is just getting outside stimuli, right? Just getting things outside of your normal routine to be added to your life. And I think the best way to do that is just to talk to other interesting people, right? I mean, people are so interesting and they have all these different experiences and knowledge and viewpoints that you don't have.
Yeah.
So I think one of the best ways to kind of get yourself back into that creative flow is to talk to people that, you know, that you may not have talked to for a while.
Yeah. There's also, I suggest a possible corollary to this, corollary to this rule, which is don't be snobby about it either.
Like, yeah, I agree.
Like, you can take meetings with your heroes, like, that's easy. Everybody's going to do that, right? But taking meetings with, like, people that are, you know, just working on their first game, or, you know, don't necessarily impress you right away, but those people still may have something valuable. They definitely will have something valuable to say, and then and then maybe in the future have something valuable to sort of offer you.
Well, it's like I think it's Google founder Larry Page says that he tries to get something out of every conversation that he has. I mean, he's running Google, right? I mean, what can you say?
Absolutely.
That? But he still has that mindset. It's like everyone has something, you know, valuable that they can share with you. So
that's funny. I learned that from just hanging around with Stephen Wolfram.
Okay.
When he talks to somebody new, he asks them like about what they do, and then he follows up with a question that's just on the edge of his own knowledge about the topic that they're an expert in.
Oh yeah.
Like every single time he talked to somebody in my presence, he would just try and learn from them. So it was a win-win situation, because first of all, he was learning something about whatever field it was, and second of all, this person got to talk, which everyone loves to do. If you have a conversation with someone and they don't talk, then that's a conversation that they hate, basically. So And then they also got to look smart in front of Stephen Wolfram, so that's...
Yeah, everyone wins there. Everyone wins.
Exactly. Cool. So what's your piece of advice, Kimon?
So I've been learning a whole bunch about social media, and I would say my piece of advice is just take the time to really go in and understand social media, because I thought I understood it, and it turned out that I really didn't know a single thing. I was like, I was as bad as your grandma at like real social media. So
in what way as bad as my grandma?
So what I was doing with social media is just kind of putting stuff out there, right? So my concept was, okay, if I put enough stuff out there, people will start, you know, like picking it up, right? This is the way social media works. Well, it turns out that that's completely not the way it should be done. The quality of your social media, and quality is very different in terms of, you know, for each platform. You have to do something different, and you really want to target each platform separately. It really comes down to the quality of what you're putting out, not just the quantity or how many people that you're blasting it out to.
So, like, the term follower might be a misleading term.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, I have no idea how valuable I'm doing the air quote thing, the followers I have on my contract work page are right now, because a lot of them were just like, okay, I'm going to – you know, pay Facebook to put out some ads and stuff like that. But I don't know, you know, if they're the kind of people that are really, like, interested in the product. And I think that if you make quality social media, which is a whole nother conversation in itself, that you'll really start to attract the people who want to be engaged in your product experience.
Right.
So that
something that you're pointing to is maybe like just the principle that in social media, what you put out there should be a service to the people who see it and not a service to yourself.
Yeah, I think that's very important. And I think a lot of like small starting companies get this very wrong, right? What they put on social media is basically like them trumpeting themselves. And like, I totally get that, right? You wanna, you feel proud of something you did, you wanna share it with others. But you got to take it from your customer's perspective, right? It's like, okay, great. You guys are doing well, but it's not doing anything for me, right?
Right.
So, yeah, it's really about building. Yeah, I think you hit it right on the head. Is you want to give something that your customer will see it and go like, wow, I just got this stuff from free, something completely for free from you. And then it puts them in the mindset is like, okay, this guy's really helping me out with all this free stuff. Maybe I'll go buy his, you know, when it comes time, I'll go buy his product because he's been such a nice guy to me.
Yeah. That's a great piece of advice. Love it.
Which will segment straight into our next part, which is called What We're. And this is just, it's a general session of like what we're playing, what we're building, reading, whatever. So for my What We're, I just talked about social media. The book that I read that basically pointed out everything I was doing wrong with social media is called Jab, 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 Punch by Gary Vaynerchuk.
He's that wine guy, right?
He is the wine guy. Very good. But yeah, as I said, like the book breaks down like per platform what you need to do different. You know, what do you need to do different on Facebook opposed to Twitter as opposed to, you know, Pinterest? And it gives like good detailed like case studies. It was a really great read for me. It really kind of opened my eyes to like all the things that I was doing wrong on social media. So highly recommended for anyone that's using social media, which should be just about everyone at this point.
Yeah. It's that actually we're I won't name names, but earlier today our mutual friend Ryan Wiemeyer of the Men Who Wear Many Hats noticed that there was a big company with several they were called like digital community representatives or something like that. They had some title which you'd think they are like basically social media community manager type people. And these, he tried to reach out to them and they did not have Twitter accounts.
Oh no.
I was like, what?
Yeah, pretty sunny. That touches on another great thing.
So you have to be in the game, even if even if you suck at first at social media, you can't win unless you play.
Yeah, and you point out a great thing in that, like, small indie companies actually have the edge here.
Yeah.
Over big corporate companies, right? Because, like, they're so worried about, like, their brand and their image, they can't really take a lot of risk in social media, whereas,
each
like...
tweet has to go through, like, four levels of management.
Exactly. Cool. So, like, as a small company, you have such an edge there. It's like, okay, I'm going to do something crazy and wild, and if it goes well, that's awesome. If it goes badly, well, like, four people will see it, so...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely take advantage of the fact that you can move, like, a million times faster than, you know... whoever, EA, whoever you're up against.
Mm.
How about you, Rob? What's your what we're?
So I am watching some Studio Ghibli or Ghibli movies. Mm-hmm.
Any in particular?
I just rented Castle in the Sky to rewatch that.
Classic.
And it's real. I don't know. There's something. So I'm working on a game that has sort of like a strong mythology component.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that this. And I'm sort of in the position of trying to create a mythology from scratch, and so was Miyazaki, and has done so many times and very successfully. And I'm just kind of trying to learn from that. There's just like these concepts that I keep calling like deep structures, and if you read Snow Crash, you kind of know what that means. But it's just like ideas that are so old to humans that mm-hmm. they're very powerful. And you know, Castle in the Sky has this idea of like a talisman, that like a protective talisman.
Okay.
Which is kind of central, and lots of people want to get their hands on this protective talisman, but it only works for one person because, of course, it's like magical.
Sure.
But there's like a twist of it being sort of technological too, which modernizes the situation. Like, she's able to summon robots with it
to okay.
protect her, and it also it's made from some sort of ore that is supposed to have all these properties that so it's never like talked about that it's magic, but clearly it is if it can like identify what person is wearing it and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's some super high technology thing that is way beyond.
Well, once you get far enough up there, right, technology
exactly.
basically turns into magic, so
right. And that's an interesting intersection for the game I'm working on too, which is about sort of computer programming and magical spells and conflating those two ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I like about Miyazaki's work is just the consistency of both the story and the style, right?
Mm.
He establishes this universe, and then everything just follows like right into there. I mean, you don't see anything out of place. You're never drawn out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, once you're in there, you know, it feels like you've gone somewhere different.
And that's sort of in my experience, and I'm a big fan of anime, but it's very like unusual for Japanese animation to be as consistent as Miyazaki is. Like, those things are often quite all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the, you know, there'll be you'll be watching this story about, you know, people fighting evil robots or whatever, and then all of a sudden, you know, somebody will mention that there's like some kind of cult that has never been mentioned before and, you know, there are people that are members of this cult and they're helping the evil robots or something. Like,
right.
They're not really good at the sort of setup and then punchline structure that you have to, that like you expect from Western screenwriting.
Mm-hmm.
But Miyazaki definitely has all of that.
Yeah,
and also the visual style is super inspiring to me. Like, this game that I'm working on has a similar like thing where the backgrounds are all super detailed and the characters are all cartoony, but it's all very fluid and it's different from Disney.
Yeah. You know
what I'm saying?
Yeah, it, like, I'm not an artist, so it really, like, blows me away to watch Miyazaki's work just for the amount of just visual fidelity that you get watching it. It really is it's like when you go to, like, a beautiful landscape. If you look at it like a huge canyon or like a mountain range, right, there's all this visual information that's coming at you very quickly. I get the same feeling when I watch his stuff, right? There's so much going on visually that it really, like, sucks you in to the universe that he's making. So a great watch for anyone. If you've seen him, watch him again. If you haven't seen him, definitely check him out.
For sure.
I'm going to wrap it here. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you'd like to submit a challenge or be a guest on the show, you can get in touch with Rob and myself. You can tweet me at Kiwon Hong. No spaces, no dashes, no anything. Or you can email me at Kiwon Hong. That's KEEWONHONG@gmail.com.
And I'm at Bobby Locks on Twitter, BobbyLox, or BobbyLox@ImportantLittleGames.com if you prefer email.
All right. Thank you much.
Much obliged.
Thanks for tuning in the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you'll be back again to share more stories from Sweet Home Chicago.